Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Stability persists. Two guests, two segments. Jacob Silverman will talk about how and why so many Silicon Valley hotshots moved to the right, and Forrest Hilton will provide a tour d'horizon, pardon my French, of political developments in South America. Over the past few weeks, I've been looking a lot at the political landscape of the Silicon Valley. Here's another installment. Jacob Silverman is just out with Gilded Rage, Elon Musk and the Radicalization of Silicon Valley, published by Bloomsbury. Not all that long ago, the dominant politics of the tech elite was centrist Democrat. Back when he first entered politics, Donald Trump told Rupert Murdoch, who's never had a very high opinion of Trump, that he thought he could win support in the Valley. Murdoch dissented, telling the political neophyte, for 8 years these guys had Obama in their pocket. They practically ran the administration. 8 years later, it looks like Trump the naive was right and the canny Murdoch was wrong. Elon Musk is the most prominent of the turncoats, but there are lots more, and there were some, notably Peter Thiel, who were already seriously right-wing. Here with names and reasons is Jacob Silverman. These guys weren't always right-wing. Their poster boy, Musk, 6 or 7 years ago, was not a reactionary. He resigned from Trump's business advisory board over his withdrawal from the Paris Accord. He bragged on Twitter about Tesla's high ratings on the LGBTQ scorecard. More generally, Silicon Valley was pretty close to Obama. What happened that pushed so many of this cohort to the right?
Well, I think there were certainly some things particular to their class, but a lot of the social and political currents that swept through the culture and the country in the COVID years especially affected these guys too. In the case of someone like Musk, there were battles over keeping his Fremont factory open. He also took very personally this as an insult, apparently, when he wasn't invited to an EV summit at the White House. And then, according to himself, he says that the woke mind virus seems to come out of his child coming out as transgender. He claimed, talking to Jordan Peterson, the woke mind virus killed my son. I think there is something to that. I think there is something also to how, for some of these people, they saw colleges and other institutions as turning young people and their own children against them. Bill Ackman said he thought that Harvard turned his daughter into a Marxist. Mark Andreessen talked about how he thought that young people were coming out of college and getting jobs at his companies in order to try to destroy them from within. So I think that was certainly part of it, too.
Some of this sounds rational and some of it sounds absolutely paranoid. How do we distinguish between these two? The idea that kids are coming out of Harvard trying to overthrow capitalism seems a little overheated.
Certainly. And, you know, there's another Andreessen point. He went to a meeting at the Biden White House, and he became convinced that the Biden administration basically wanted to suppress the AI industry into nothing, maybe choose one company, allow it to be the winner. And it just doesn't sound like anything that one might expect out of even a Democratic administration that did some tech regulation.
Now, another factor you read about is the end of the zero interest rate policy, all the free money that came out of the Fed, starting with the Great Recession, but then intensified with COVID. So, like, we had a decade where money was virtually free if you were the right kind of person. What effect did that have on their upswing and then on their souring?
Well, I think it had a big effect in the 2010s because they were able to borrow huge amounts of money. Also, huge amounts of money were just coming their way from sovereign wealth funds in the Middle East and elsewhere. These bets in venture capital on startups that might have been a few million dollars started turning into hundreds of millions and eventually billion-dollar rounds on some tech companies. There's just a lot more at stake. They bet on a lot of technologies like crypto and NFTs and Web3 type stuff that didn't amount to much except raw speculation. Still, they came out of that period, that zero interest rate period, richer than ever and more successful than ever. But in some ways, like, their rhetoric didn't always match what they had to show for it. Someone like Mark Andreessen, again, would say it's time to build and talk about building. You hear that kind of rhetoric from a lot of these guys. What were they building? They were building mostly gambling apps and speculative instruments in crypto.
These guys are not the most democratic in their instincts. Alex Karp of Palantir is saying that protesters should be sent to North Korea and forced to eat tree bark. A lot of them just want to, like, secede from our society, create their own, like, CEO dictatorship. Talk to them about their relationship to the idea of political democracy. They're not very fond of it.
That's right. It's not a core value for them. It's not something they're very attached to. I mean, whether they're like to be a little bit contrarian or whether they're actually actively anti-democratic or monarchist, some of them are now, especially the people who listen to Curtis Yarvin. They just don't care about democracy and a shared, ostensibly fair political playing field under which left or right your ideas and policies are contested in sort of the normal electoral way. We hear it more explicitly from someone like Peter Thiel, who wrote decades ago that he saw democracy as in tension with freedom and with unfettered capitalism, and he certainly prefers capitalism. This is something that has kind of manifested itself throughout their careers and now increasingly in their political activities. And in some ways, they have always been interested in this libertarian idea of exit, and especially someone like Thiel. But now that some of those ideas haven't come to fruition, they're still doing the charter city thing, or like, as you mentioned, these little kind of corporate city states where they can be CEO dictators. But they have a lot of money to deploy, so I think the shift we saw in the last election was really a concerted effort by certain right-wing tech elites plus the crypto industry to capture the political process in a way they hadn't before.
A lot of these characters have found a home politically in the Trump administration, some of them literally holding office in the administration, others just enthusiastic supporters. Now, is this a marriage of convenience? Are there sort of deeper affinities? How do you really read the connection to Trump?
It depends sometimes who we're talking about. You know, Mark Zuckerberg seems like someone who's deeply opportunistic, but also, you know, Trump has said that he wanted to imprison Zuckerberg. Things that sound a little absurd, but, you know, there's an element of self-preservation for a lot of these guys. A lot of them were facing investigations, whether civil or criminal, into their companies or aspects of their operations. The New York Times chronicled more than a dozen investigations into Musk and his companies. So there's a protective element here. Trump even said at a crypto industry gathering a few months back, he said, "You guys were in so much trouble." Or there's the famous comment from Elon Musk. He said, "If Kamala is elected, I'm screwed. I'm going to prison." I think that kind of thing was actually very real. Some of it might have been a little overblown or a little bit from the paranoid billionaire mind that we're talking about, but there were real things at stake here. Certainly we've seen in the way that a lot of crypto guys have received pardons or SEC cases dropped, there were real benefits. There is ideological alignment. There are especially a lot of shared grievances. Like when I talk about the rage and anger among these guys, a lot of them were sort of partially radicalized to the right by perceived woke excesses, anger at identity politics, and the effects that it had on their lives and their companies. And especially in the case of someone like Elon Musk, I think he's really found common cause with MAGA with his transphobia. Even if it didn't necessarily help compel him to the right, it's something that goes down very easily with MAGA and with Trump.
You quote some stuff from Andreessen, who he's trying to argue that he's not really a member of the elite. Culture people are the elites, and you know he's just a member of the professional managerial class. I was surprised to see him endorse the Ehrenreich's essays on the PMC, but how do these guys see their class position? They don't seem to think of themselves as immensely powerful because of all their money.
Yeah, and certainly some of that could be a pose or a matter of self-interest too, but it also seems to reflect this naivety, this notion that their ideas, or this ignorance, I guess, their ideas often aren't grounded in much beyond their own discipline, even though they seem to think they know about everything. I mean, I think someone like Andreessen does read, or at least presents himself as a reader and someone with intellectual interests, but he still has the attitude I think is more broadly felt that they are somehow put upon. He also said in the part you're quoting that, yeah, he's just sort of the steward of other people's capital, which in this case means like the Saudi government. But, you know, this guy is also a billionaire who is married to a billionaire property heiress, and he is a huge figure in tech. If anyone is a captain of industry or something like that, it's him. But there's this refusal there. Musk has said he doesn't like unions because he doesn't like a lords and peasants thing, but no one runs his companies with more imperiousness than he does. You can ascribe some of this to ignorance and also some of it to a convenient self-interest.
Not to kick around Andreessen too much, although it's fun. His contempt for expertise is wild. You quote him saying in a tweet, I think it was, "Everything you read makes sense if you simply translate experts as crazy people." He's in a field where technical expertise makes it all happen, supplemented with financial expertise. But his contempt for expertise certainly harmonizes nicely with Trump's own worldview, but they couldn't exist without a high degree of expertise. What sense do you make of that?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this. I was actually talking about it with someone earlier today. Well, one, they really don't like to recognize authorities or expertise outside their own domain. I mean, they share the kind of right-wing and reactionary distaste for American institutions, whether they're universities or the government or whatever else. They certainly don't seem inclined to acknowledge the profound influence that government investment has had in creating their fortunes and everything we call Silicon Valley. They very much like to also think that they arrive at first principles themselves and that they know everything. I also think that the fact that a lot of these people, not someone like Andreessen, who Andreessen finished college and I think has a PhD or graduate degree and certainly helped create the web browser in a government-funded lab. But a lot of these guys dropped out of college, or in the case of Peter Thiel, pay people to drop out of college and may not be so widely read in the humanities. But I think they also finally see it as an encroachment upon their power. And one last thing that I've been thinking about is Doge, actually. And if you look at what happened with Doge, which in some ways still exists, like a lot of those personnel are still in place, it came from this idea that tech elites are kind of the new consultant class, that they can figure out anything. They don't need to know anything about the Social Security Administration or government payment systems or USAID or whatever else it might be. They can come in and instantly get acclimated and figure it out. And because of their skill as engineers or whatever else is valued by Silicon Valley, they can improve everything.
I'm speaking with Jacob Silverman, author of Gilded Rage, just out from Bloomsbury. Silicon Valley, as you mentioned, has always been very wrapped up with the Pentagon, with government funding. The internet, of course, would not exist without decades of government funding. Yet they seem to have taken it up a few notches in recent years, much more involved in the national security state explicitly. And you have somebody like Palmer Luckey, who is the co-founder of Anduril. And what is it with these guys in their Lord of the Rings business? But he became a symbol of this kind of new weapons are cool culture. What about their relation to the Pentagon? And, you know, it's much more explicit than it used to be.
Yes, very much so. And certainly these two areas have always been wrapped up in one another, and it can be a complicated history at times. But now what's really changed is that there's very little pretense and certainly no embarrassment about it. I mean, now it's considered cool in some areas, or like America's strong and worth defending and we should want to make weapons for it. If you're Palmer Luckey or like Alex Karp from Palantir or some of these other guys, they talk, and I'm just paraphrasing them mildly, but they say America should have the strongest, most fearsome weapons so that our enemies are too afraid to attack us. They certainly never talk about diplomacy or anything like that. That's the thing, is this idea of building up America and enforcing peace through intimidation. And, of course, that buildup could be very profitable for them. And the China hawkishness is part of this, too. China's sort of the big enemy here, along with terrorist groups and other sort of unnamed enemies of America. But there's no worries about the war on terror years or other ways of thinking allowed to penetrate here. And sometimes it can sound very juvenile and jingoistic. But it's, of course, very profitable. And you also see it going into mainstream tech, both in terms of investment, but just take Google as an example, which I talk about in my book. About 7 years ago, there were some Google employees who protested against something called Project Maven, which was an imaging project for the DoD processing drone imagery. Google employees said, we don't want to do this because, you know, this might contribute to people getting killed by these drones. People protested, and Google responded by dropping the deal, which was not a huge one. I think it was less than $20 million, not huge for Google. But 7 years later, employees of Google protested about its work for the Israeli government and the IDF, and those people were immediately fired in mild protests. They were just silent protests. They didn't really involve any disruption. So things have really changed.
You mentioned the IDF. They certainly seem to be very loyal to the Israeli military, both, it seems, for material reasons. They like the weapons contracts. They like the research that Israeli entities do. But also, they seem to have an ideological affinity, too. They hated all the campus protests, for example.
Yeah, and among a lot of the tech elites, they have real contempt for the campus protests. It depends on the companies and the venture capital firms, but broadly speaking, you know, there's a lot of VC investment in Israeli tech companies. There's a real veneration of Israeli tech talent, especially that coming out of the Israeli military, like Unit 8200, which is the top surveillance and cyber unit. And even in Silicon Valley, there's a group, kind of an alumni group for members of Unit A200 who work at various tech companies and law firms throughout Silicon Valley. Sometimes this stuff is more behind the scenes, but in the case of Sequoia Capital, the most important firm in VC, and its partner Sean McGuire, who you may have seen ranting in classic paranoid right-wing fashion on Twitter.
He stands out among an egregious crowd.
Yeah, and I wrote about him a bit in my book, and I wrote a profile of him for Business Insider of the summer, and he is the loudest among these people, but he does represent this new kind of consensus of the warrior VC, which may sound a little silly in a way. He is a Jewish convert, I believe, and is married to a woman with ties to Israel. He's gone to Israel a bunch of times and helped lead this sort of resurgence of investments in Israeli tech companies, both by his own employer and others. And this is something that's a very big deal to him. That he employs classic war and terror rhetoric that there are terrorist sleeper cells led by Zohran Mamdani's father here in the U.S. and that, you know, we are in this battle of the West against everyone else and the West against even Islam at times, he says. You hear a lot of the saving the West kind of rhetoric, even if they're not indulging as much Islamophobic stuff as Sean McGuire does, like that saving Western civilization stuff you hear all the time from the defense tech people.
David Sacks is a guy you write about some. He doesn't get quite the attention that Thiel and especially Musk get, but he's an important player. So who exactly is Sacks and what's he been up to?
Sacks was friends with Peter Thiel in college and law school. They met each other at Stanford. They became writing partners, also from Southern Africa. Thiel spent some time in Southwest Africa, which is dominated by apartheid South Africa, is now Namibia. Sacks spent part of his childhood in South Africa. He's Jewish and then immigrated to the U.S. and they met at Stanford. They co-wrote this book, The Diversity Myth, this really bitter anti-multiculturalism, anti-identity politics book that they published in the early 90s. It had a lot of support actually from, I think it was the Libertarian Institute and different people in the Republican establishment. This is the book where they minimize rape or kind of deny the reality of campus rape and accuse activists of demonizing men. And they apologize for some portions of the book, both Thiel and Sacks, during the 2016 election cycle, and some of this came back into view. But it's interesting. I mean, I wouldn't recommend the book, but if you go back and look at it, it could be written today, but just like every instance of multiculturalism will be replaced by woke. It's a lot of the same grievances, and Thiel certainly has been even just giving a lot of versions of the same speech drawn from that book for almost 20 years, a lot of it at universities. And so they're very much like-minded in that way. And both dyed-in-the-wool political animals. There are a few clips of David Sacks on C-SPAN over the years. But most of his career, he was at PayPal. He was an executive there and founding member of the PayPal Mafia. Had some important CEO positions after that, but didn't really come into his own as a political person, I would say, or at least someone of public prominence until around the pandemic era. He was giving donations mostly to Republicans before that, but Thiel was really the leading tech conservative. And it was around 2020, especially when he started getting involved in recall elections in California, that Sacks ascended to that Thiel echelon.
Joe Lonsdale, not as famous as some of the others, but a very important figure in this world, one of the co-founders of Palantir. You have to sign an NDA, non-disclosure agreement, to visit his house?
Yeah, I don't know if he has a different one for close friends, to be honest, but the one that was shared with me is someone who is a delivery driver. I probably should get more specific than that. And they went multiple times, and he has a security booth, as a very rich person might, but you have to sign an NDA and permission or agreement to be surveilled. This happened a couple times at least, and I'm not an expert in NDAs, but I talked to a couple lawyers, and this seemed unusual. It had this intergenerational clause. Like, of course, the NDA was completely restrictive. Even if you're dropping off a burrito, you can't say anything you saw or may have observed, but also it had an intergenerational clause where it's binding upon your children and Joe Lonsdale's descendants, which is something that I don't know would ever be enforced in court or even end up in court, but it shows kind of the absurd lengths. You know, we're way beyond these guys just living in gay communities. They are trying to ensconce themselves in this cocoon of security and privacy and privilege in every way that they can.
A theme that runs through the book is Saudi Arabia. It's both a source of investment capital for these guys, But also, it seems to be something of a political ideal for them as well, right? Monarchies run by money. That seems to be their ideal.
Yeah. Singapore has always been another kind of lesser model for Silicon Valley or a friend to them. Singapore sovereign wealth funds and financial firms provide a lot of money, and that's benevolent dictatorship, supposedly, that has often appealed to Silicon Valley. But in recent years, you know, the rise of Middle Eastern sovereign wealth funds, and especially Saudi Arabia, as at times the leading funder of U.S. tech startups, has really had, I think, a noticeable effect, or one that deserves, you know, investigation. I think it was really summed up in this comment that Ben Horowitz, Mark Andreessen's partner at Andreessen Horowitz, made in a Saudi-focused investment conference, where he said, "You have a founder too, except you call him Your Highness." And founder, of course, is the most hallowed identity within Silicon Valley. I mean, venture capitalist might be a close second for some of these people, but founder, builder, venture capitalist, like, these are the identities who are, well, they're all mostly male and rule with an iron fist, are supposed to have some great vision and have an authoritarian style. That makes a lot of sense, or matches with the bond that they form, some of them personal, between leading venture capitalists or leading executives and MBS, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. And of course, Saudi Arabia wants to make money. They want to diversify their economic interests. And they also want to use U.S. technology to further repression at home. So that's another reason why I do talk a lot about the Saudi Twitter relationship and how it's continued into X, but how Twitter in particular has been used as a tool of repression in Saudi Arabia. So, you know, I think it's a complicated and multifaceted relationship, but I think that essential authoritarianism and the ability to rule your country by fiat is super appealing to venture capitalists, especially those who would like to solicit billions from MBS.
And J.D. Vance is an important character in this world. He's sort of an adhesive that holds pieces of the structure together, like Thiel and Yarvin, but then he's also in the Trump administration. Talk some about the role of J.D. Vance in this world.
Vance may not have the sort of MAGA charisma of Trump. I don't know if the movement will be able to hold together whenever Trump might decide to depart from the political scene, but he does bind these sort of interests together, as you say. He's a former venture capitalist. He basically hitched his life to Peter Thiel after hearing him speak at Yale Law School and decided this is someone who he really respected. He liked Peter Thiel's actual religiosity. He liked how he talked about his faith. He liked that he thought he was really smart and sort of promising a different way than Vance envisioned for himself. So when there was a dinner during the 2024 campaign at Sachs's mansion in San Francisco, a lot of the familiar names, like kind of the All In and PayPal Mafia crews, were there, and they encouraged Trump to pick J.D. Vance because they think of him as a VC, as a venture capitalist, and as one of theirs. And the fact that Vance has that, and then he has his new right credentials and his sort of religious conservatism credentials, will matter going ahead. And it's certainly, you know, he's someone who they see as their man inside the White House at the moment.
And finally, do you see any cracks in this structure, or their power pretty secure?
One revealing thing was that when Musk left, as his term as a special government employee expired, and he and Trump fell out soon after that, I believe, there still wasn't a lot of retribution or wider upheaval within the administration. The government, at least for now, still needs Musk companies and needs SpaceX, especially for rocket launches. Musk has a lot of problems on his own with the future of Tesla, I think. But everyone else stayed in place. Most of the Doge personnel are still there. Yes, there's been some pushback or people rehired, but a lot of those operatives that we've heard about are still seated throughout the Trump administration. For now, we're seeing this bond hold. I think it can work because Trump is so transactional and practices a kind of patronage form of governance and is willing to pour a lot of money into AI data centers and defense tech and other interests of the tech industry. There could be potential fractures. You know, I don't think this is something that lasts forever, but or lasts throughout however many terms Trump ends up serving. But yeah, I think for now, like, the incentives and the alignment are there. Unless something particularly egregious happens to provoke open warfare between these two factions, you know, there's still people on the MAGA right, like Steve Bannon, who hate big tech. But, you know, I think they're both benefiting from each other, and a lot of people in the tech industry are still kissing the ring.
That was Jacob Silverman, author of Gilded Rage, just out from Bloomsbury. His previous book was Easy Money, Cryptocurrency, Casino Capitalism, and the Golden Age of Fraud. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Some of Domenico Scarlatti's Sonata in B-flat, number 248 in the Kirkpatrick catalog, performed by Scott Ross. Next, a tour of political developments in several countries in South America and in U.S. relations with them, Argentina, Venezuela, Colombia, Brazil, and Bolivia, conducted by the historian and frequent Behind the News guest, Forrest Hilton. I contacted Forrest after reading a piece of his in the London Review of Books website about the recent election in Bolivia, which saw the centrist Rodrigo Paz Pereira defeating a far-right candidate on a platform touting popular capitalism. The days when Evo Morales and his movement for socialism dominated politics in the country are long gone. This made me want to know more about how that fit in with trends across the region. Javier Milei's crackpot libertarianism in Argentina, saved by $40 billion in funding from the U.S. Treasury, which enabled him to win some crucial elections last weekend, and Trump's moves towards toppling Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela. Forrest teaches history at the Federal University of Bahia in Brazil. Forrest Hilton. Milei got his victory with the help of $40 billion in U.S. money. What do you make of it?
Trump gives himself a lot of credit for it. And he's not wrong, but that doesn't necessarily resolve the question of exactly how much money it's going to take to prevent Argentina from collapsing. So the victory was definitely, it was bought and paid for, and it made a big difference. It's hard to see Milei coming out ahead in those midterms otherwise. For now, they're kind of riding high, but the future remains uncertain when it comes to Argentina's currency and the exchange rate against the dollar and any kind of stability. Plus, the cost, we don't really know yet what's in the fine print. For every favor that is done to Argentina, presumably something is being given in return. So we'll see just how much of Argentina ends up essentially in the hands of the Treasury Department or, more likely, private investors.
We also see Trump really like bombing all over the Caribbean, taking out little boats. What do you make of his general policy? He seems to think back to the drug war again.
We have the precedent of Operation Just Cause in Panama in 1989 when they invaded and took out the dangerous drug trafficker Manuel Noriega, who had been a CIA contract agent for quite some time. I think that Trump, in a lot of ways, seems to be going back to Theodore Roosevelt and the idea that he could do whatever he wants in the Caribbean, up to and including Venezuela, because it has the oil. So, you know, in terms of flexing his muscles without any prior consultation with Congress and potentially even going to war or escalating military action, seems quite possible. There's precedent for this. You know, in terms of bombing these drug boats, the way the drug business works nowadays is through container ships and the ports. That's why Guayaquil has become so important. I think it handles at least a third of, I think it was like 2,600 metric tons or something that Colombia produced, a record bonanza in cocaine, and a third of it goes through Guayaquil through the container ships. Some of that is directly connected to the president of Guayaquil and his family's businesses, and these are known facts. The case that Trump's making for invading Venezuela or bombing it is a case, you know, he could legitimately make if he chose to for Ecuador, except that it's an incredibly close ally. And probably Trump is expecting to be able to install military bases there again because the current president wants that to happen and campaigned on it. So the pretext is obviously bogus, but as I'm saying, the container ships are the key to the movement of cocaine. And the little boats that he's bombing, they're not significant in the cocaine business. But if you look next door to Venezuela at the part of Guyana that's full of oil and that Venezuela claims as its own, then I think we've got something more like solid in terms of what Trump is actually up to in Venezuela. The narcotics stuff is a ridiculous pretext given how things work in Ecuador. The real purpose is grabbing the oil. And Trump said it publicly after his first term in office was up, I think it was, that essentially the military wouldn't let him invade Venezuela and take its oil, which is what he had planned to do and wanted to do, and wasn't it a shame that he hadn't been able to do so? So he's announced essentially what his angle is on Venezuela.
And Marco Rubio has really been a regime change guy in Venezuela for some time, right?
I think since birth. No, it's almost genetic with Rubio. When it comes to Cuba or Venezuela, or Colombia for that matter, when former President Álvaro Uribe was condemned to 12 years of house arrest, Rubio was like, yeah, this is politically motivated. This is just what they tried to do to Trump. We're not going to stand for it because Uribe's our guy. He's made it pretty clear what politicians are U.S. allies and what politicians are U.S. enemies. But Rubio's bona fides when it comes to regime change in Venezuela go back more than 20 years. And the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, Maria Corina Machado, that was indirectly a peace prize for Trump and for the politics of regime change, because that's the only politics Maria Corina Machado has ever been interested in. So, you know, regime change as doctrine for Venezuela seems to be official, but then it gets tricky in terms of, let's say, mechanics and logistics, because things didn't go so well in Iraq. And there's a lot of military, presumably high-level military people who are aware of that and are aware that they could potentially go much worse in Venezuela. And I believe that's what Trump was told the first time he wanted to take this plan out for a spin, and they wouldn't let him. You know, he's obviously mobilized an enormous amount of military hardware and personnel, but it's difficult to know how much of that is more than show and how much of it is just that, a show of force. Presumably bombing drug boats and killing people in relatively small numbers is a policy he could maintain without a great deal of damage. Ironically, he's pushing Venezuela and Colombia very close together. Relations between the two have been quite difficult ever since Álvaro Uribe became president in 2002. Yet the countries are united in a way that very few countries in South America are. Uruguay and Argentina come to mind, but Venezuela and Colombia share a great deal. Trump's policies have really pushed Petro closer to Maduro in terms of a regional solution to Venezuela's problem.
What about sanctioning Petro as a big-time coke dealer?
This is astonishing because if you were to adopt that as a policy, the first country you'd have to hit would be Ecuador. And as I said, the president there, Daniel Noboa, his family businesses are up to their necks in the export of cocaine through the port facilities of Guayaquil and the containers. And they've been caught in recent years. This is a matter of public record. Naming Petro as Colombia's leading drug trafficker, I believe Trump's logic was, well, Colombia produces all the cocaine, and therefore the president of Colombia must be the biggest narco trafficker.
Well, that's the way Trump thinks. The president is identical to the state, to the country.
Yes, yes, this the absolutist mentality.
L'état, c'est moi.
Yes, yes, that's what I mean. He may have difficulty understanding how the business works in Colombia and why Ecuador has become so important to it, but President Petro has been lobbying for more rational narcotics policies of decriminalization and regional cooperation as opposed to unilateral action by the DEA for many years, decades, in fact. And Petro was very opposed to the use of, gosh, what was it called? Roundup Ultra, was the name of the chemicals that were used to fumigate aerial fumigation of coca crops. They destroy watersheds, livelihoods, communities, and people's health. And Petro was extremely opposed to the use of aerial fumigation with glyphosate.
Oh, glyphosate, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and Roundup Ultra. So Petro's approach, he tried to negotiate peace with arguably the leading drug traffickers of Colombia, which would be the paramilitary or neo-paramilitary organization called the Autodefensas Gaitanistas de Colombia. And he was simultaneously trying to negotiate peace with the remnants of the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, which negotiated peace in 2016, only to be massacred thereafter. Trying to solve the narcotics problem in Colombia requires a peace process or a political process with both the FARC remnants and the AGC, Autodefensas Gaitanistas de Colombia, the AGC paramilitaries. And Petro did his best to negotiate peace and was unable to do so. So he really deserves credit for approaching the whole question of narcotics as a political issue and trying to find a political solution for these armed groups that are the real major traffickers in Colombia. The FARC remnants have some very significant traffickers, but the paramilitary groups have far more significant presence throughout the country and trafficking networks for export. And they control various ports in conjunction with their Mexican associates. If Trump were interested in the major traffickers in Colombia, he would immediately see that they are and have long been the allies of the Colombian military in the struggle to eliminate the FARC. You know, a number of their leaders, the kind of the old guard leaders, were extradited to the United States for charges of narco-trafficking, recognized as the biggest traffickers in the country. Most of them served their sentences in the United States and returned to Colombia already. So it's a new generation of paramilitaries. They're not really interested anymore in necessarily fighting the FARC. They're mostly interested in business and consolidating their share versus whatever the competition happens to be.
I'm speaking with the historian of Latin America, Forrest Hilton, racing around the continent. I was just reading that Trump has shifted his affections from Bolsonaro, who he now views as a loser, to Lula. What's happening there and in Brazil more generally?
It was at the United Nations when Trump said, yeah, I met Lula in the hallway and I liked him and we're going to talk. So Eduardo Bolsonaro, the son of former President Jair Bolsonaro, was in the United States, you know, lobbying Trump and pushing hard for the 50% tariffs. And all of a sudden, he was thrown and his father was thrown under the bus because Trump changed his mind. Trump's more interested in cutting deals with Brazil than he is in carrying the torch for a guy who's going to jail. I'm pretty sure Bolsonaro got a sentence of 20 years, but the generals, a bunch of generals, got sentences of 26, 27, 24 years. Former head of intelligence. I mean, we're talking the highest levels of the Brazilian state and military, something that has never happened in the United States and has never happened in Brazil either. So as in Colombia, the judiciary has proven to some degree its independence from politics in sentencing these people because the political pressure to let them off the hook was incredibly strong. So for the first time, there are consequences for high-level military people and a former president. And I'm sure they'll get house arrest, but nevertheless, they're not going to be organizing any coups or assassination attempts on Lula anytime soon. So this is interesting. Lula was really in trouble. He was in deep trouble because his government is quite neoliberal and there's very little progressive about it. They were losing voters in the Northeast and among young people, which is where they had enjoyed the greatest advantage. And along comes Trump and starts attacking Brazil and maligning its judiciary. And Lula was forced to some degree to take a stand and defend what little Brazil still has of national sovereignty. And this played incredibly well in Brazil across the board. His own base, you know, rallied around him immediately. But Lula's popularity is at an all-time high right now. and polls have him winning in the first round. And this has been the case for like the last month or so. And he says he's going to run again. He's feeling great, he says. Unlike Trump or Biden, he really has his faculties and his wits about him. This is his greatest moment of triumph. But as with Malay, it's all going to be in the fine print. You know, what is Lula going to give away in order to get some sort of deal with Trump? And that remains to be seen. But for the moment, Lula has offered to mediate with Venezuela. And I think that could prove to be important because I don't think Trump would consider anyone else of sufficient stature to mediate.
Highly respected, as Trump likes to say of people.
Yes, exactly. And that's what Lula has now become in his eyes. Ironically, Trump's embrace of Lula might well lead to a de-escalation of military conflict in the Caribbean and with Venezuela. Obviously, Brazil has a lot at stake should the United States undertake some sort of war with ground troops in Venezuela. And Itamaraty, which is the foreign ministry, I'm sure is going to be working overtime now on diplomatic and peace initiatives. And they'll have a very easy time gathering regional support for such an initiative that Trump will be open to from the outset. What he will agree to in terms of mediation is anyone's guess. But he will be open to, rather than against, the idea of Lula mediating this conflict with Venezuela, which is only a conflict in the sense that Trump wants to go to war with Venezuela, and it wants the oil that Venezuela is claiming in Guyana. And the head of Southcom was talking about our natural resources, our lithium in Bolivia and Argentina, and the importance of our lithium there, and also the importance of our oil in the disputed part of Guyana. There's not a real mystery when it comes to what the dispute is about. And really, Brazil has an enormous interest. There's a lot at stake for Brazil, both with the oil in Guyana and what happens to it, and the conflict with Maduro right now. So this is Lula's moment on the international stage, both in terms of negotiating some sort of deal for Brazil that is not completely unfavorable to Brazil.
Moving along, Bolivia, the topic of a piece you just published in the London Review website. A right-winger lost to a Christian Democrat by a pretty decisive margin, 55-45. What's it all mean?
A couple of years ago, the former vice president of Bolivia, Alvaro Garcia Linera, was in Buenos Aires, where he's something of a celebrity. And he was saying that if Evo Morales and MAS, the Movimiento al Socialismo, continued on course with its, what in Bolivia is called the Champa Guerra, an internal war, then the right might well win in 2025. He said if Evo Morales and the incumbent president, Luis Arce, both from the same party, Luis Arce was Evo's finance minister during the golden age of gas exports, which lasted roughly from 2006 to 2014. Arce, the incumbent, was insistent upon running, and so was former president Evo Morales. And obviously, they would be disputing the same votes. Morales was technically barred from running, but he wanted to do so anyway. And so he campaigned for null votes and got 20% of the vote in the first round. However, in a way, it was the king of cement, Samuel Doria Medina, who came in third in the first round of the elections, who was able to play kingmaker. He immediately said that he wasn't going to support the far right-wing candidate of Jorge Tuto Quiroga, which was Trump's candidate, who said he would let the DEA back in, he would renegotiate the lithium deals with China and Russia so that the U.S. could, you know, basically monopolize it.
It is our lithium, after all, right?
Yeah, exactly. So he was the candidate, Jorge Tuto Quiroga, who got 45% of the vote, I think it was, who insisted that he would reverse all of the policies enacted during Evo Morales' presidency and Luis Arce's presidency, and really move in the direction of Javier Milei, as well as in the direction of a restoration of a militarized neoliberalism that was overthrown by insurrection in Bolivia in 2003. He was openly campaigning to restore the old regime, both in terms of neoliberal policy and in terms of militarized repression and political witch hunts. He promised that he would send Evo Morales to prison if he won. The guy who came in third, the King of Cement, he got about 19.7% of the vote, I think it was. He said he was going to support the guy who won in the first round, which was this guy who won in the second round, who is going to be president of Bolivia, Rodrigo Paz Pereira. And so Paz Pereira, I don't want to say he was a political nobody exactly. He came from a political lineage, and a very distinguished one at that. But he himself was not particularly important and didn't have a lot of traction until he teamed up with his vice president, Edmond Lara. There's a new kind of politician emerging throughout Latin America that doesn't come out of politics. And so Edmond Lara would be an example of one of these people who went into the police force at a very young age in Santa Cruz and then denounced police corruption and then made TikTok videos about police corruption. He became a lawyer and small businessman and ex-policeman turned crusading citizen. This played very well in Bolivia. And of course, he built a mass following with these videos. So when he was chosen as the vice presidential candidate, there was all the sudden traction in the candidacy of Rodrigo Paz Pereira that there hadn't been and would not have been otherwise. The guy who came in third in the first round, he said he was throwing his weight behind Paz Pereira and this guy Edmond Lara. And so it was very difficult for Jorge Tuto Quiroga to get the requisite votes in the second round, but the pollsters had him crushing it both in the first round and in the second round. So not for the first time, the polls were just disastrously misleading. They don't pick up a lot of the voters who actually decide outcomes in Bolivia, and many of those voters live in urban areas like El Alto, which is La Paz's sister city, and to some degree has even eclipsed La Paz now as kind of a cultural, political, and intellectual hub. So La Paz has always been difficult for anyone to dominate. Its politics seem to veer all over the place, but El Alto and other cities with really large informal sectors, that public was very open to the message of capitalism for all, popular capitalism, national democratic capitalism, because ultimately that's what Evo Morales and Movimiento al Socialismo were pushing. They were not pushing socialismo, and it was not possible for them to do so. In a way, Paz Pereira and Edmond Lara, his vice president, represent some continuity with Mas rather than a clear rupture or total break. What Paz Pereira does in power is a different story, and we'll see what role Edmond Lara is going to play in his presidency. Because in Colombia, Petro had the support of Francia Márquez. This was extremely important during his campaign in 2022. She helped rally the grassroots base and got people out to vote. And he subsequently marginalized her completely. And it's been disastrous for his presidency. So it's not hard to see Paz Pereira doing the same thing, taking distance from his vice president, precisely because the vice president is much more closely associated with the urban working class, indigenous, and mixed people who make up a majority of voters, or close to it. Paz Pereira is already moving closer to the centers of power in Bolivia in terms of finance and banking, as well as the U.S. Embassy, and we'll see what role Edmond Lara has to play and whether there is any democratic component to Bolivian capitalism going forward. I'm skeptical, but I see it as a very shrewd move in terms of how do you run a campaign and win in Bolivia if you're not Movimiento al Socialismo. It was a very effective campaign in part because this guy Edmond Lara was very successful at the media and communications of the campaign in a language and using symbolism that really resonated with Bolivia's popular sectors, something that Paz Pereira himself would have been completely incapable of doing because he's born and bred in a kind of political elite and has a master's degree from American University and is not in any way connected to the urban indigenous worlds of the West that they won by margins of 20% and 30%. Now, what's interesting is this guy, Edmond Lara, he moved to Santa Cruz from Cochabamba pretty early in life and has been in Santa Cruz ever since. So you wouldn't have thought necessarily that he would be able to make such inroads into the western highlands and highland valleys that were the strongholds of Evo Morales and Mas. But he did, and I believe it was because of communications, but also because people really want to improve their standards of living. And the idea of popular capitalism has broad appeal in Bolivia as a way to improve standard of living.
Finally, a couple of years ago, people were talking about a pink tide 2.0 in Latin America. Was there any truth to it then, and where is it now?
It's difficult to think in those terms at this point. We're at a different world historical conjuncture now. And so what you see is more of a patchwork. And in some places, such as Argentina, Trump and his allies are firmly in command. In Ecuador, there was just a series of month-long protests, which the military effectively shut down. It's a very mixed picture, I'd say, but even in places like Argentina, where the worst elements are in power, the popular response in terms of resistance, mobilization, and things like general strikes has been very impressive. Someone like Milei, he's not a very stable ruler, and therefore it's very difficult to say how things are going to go in most of these different scenarios. Seems to be rather unstable, but there's no reason for hopelessness in terms of a kind of right-wing sweep of Latin America. And if you look at what's going on in Peru right now, the protests are continuing in the face of tremendous military and police repression, and there's no signs of them abating. I think we'll continue to see that level of protest and mobilization led by young people in many cases in response to these right-wing authoritarian governments where they hold sway. And then the question is, in the places where the progressive governments are in charge, what can grassroots movements do to hold them accountable to their original campaign promises?
That was the historian Forrest Hilton. You can find a lot of his topical work on the London Review of Books website. A clarification. We talked about the possibility of a pink tide 2.0. The original pink tide was a leftward turn in the late 1990s and early 2000s. It receded as tides are wont to do. Also, as tides are wont to do, it came in again in the late 2010s and early 2020s, and on first glance, looks to be receding again. But as Forrest said, there's no reason for hopelessness, which I may adopt as my motto. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Ethel Cain's American Teenager. I learned on the internet that Cain is a singer-songwriter with a cult following of mostly young liberal arts students. I'm not one of those, but I like her anyway. Till next week, bye.